Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We find ourselves in the middle of a pandemic. On one side, scientists sharing expertise on how the virus spreads and ways in which we might protect ourselves. On the other, politicians and policymakers pushing against those words of caution in order to save our economic prospects. That, of course, is a natural inclination and a necessary one unless we wish to be plunged into an economic catastrophe, but it is a fine line to walk, made that much more difficult when you consider that many of those in charge have a history of denying science and/or ignoring its findings. All of us have hopes for a successful future, but not one based on magical thinking. Scientific thought will always trump that because science is based on facts. This trend towards science denial, however, is nothing new. It first reared its head about 400 years ago when Italian astronomer Galileo Galilei had the timidity to suggest the Earth was not the center of the universe. Pope Paul V, the spiritual and political leader of the day, ordered him to abandon that opinion because it flew in the face of religious belief. He complied, but only until a new pope came to power, a friend, or so he thought, and that's when he reasserted his opinion, only to be greeted by a charge of vehement suspicion of heresy. Well, we now know Galileo was correct, and in 1992, the Catholic Church finally acknowledged they had been wrong. Since science and its findings appear to be under attack again, we spend this hour examining what we might learn from all of this. Mario Livio is an internationally known astrophysicist and best-selling author, a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He's written Galileo and the Science Deniers, and he joins us for the hour. Thank you for being here this morning. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
Given Galileo's historical importance, both in terms of his heresy accusations by the Catholic Church and his work as a scientist, a lot of people have written about him over the years. I think there were a lot of contemporary books written about him while he was still alive or just after he died. But you are an astrophysicist yourself. Are you the first astrophysicist to write about Galileo?
I think I may be, yes. At least I would say the first currently still doing research astrophysicist who has written about Galileo, yes. Most people who have written about him were science historians, science writers, and the likes, not normally active research scientists.
Given the comparative science, where we are today and where we were back when Galileo was using his very primitive telescope to examine the heavens, why is he important, given the fact that they knew so little back then and the instruments they had to work with were so primitive and everything was at the start? Why is he important?
So he's important for many reasons, but let me just give a couple, to make the point. He's important because he is, in some sense, the founder of modern science as we know it. He's the person who said that there is only one way to establish facts about nature or the universe, and that is patient experimentation, observations, and then reasoning based on the data that come from those experiments and observations. He's also important because he was a fighter for intellectual which is important at any time, and especially also today.
And people have to understand that to go up against the church back then was, I can't think of a contemporary comparison to what that would mean today. Can you?
Well, I would say, maybe if you are funded by the government and you go completely against the government or something to that effect, yes. If you live in a totalitarian regime and you go against a dictator.
You worked on the Hubble Telescope project, and you referred to that telescope in the preface of your book as the great-great-great-grandson of Galileo's telescope, the one with which he, I guess, revolutionized our basic understanding of the cosmos. Put that into perspective, given the primitive nature of his telescope and what he could see, and the early scientific, the primitive scientific knowledge of the 1600s. Put that achievement into perspective.
Yeah, so look, let me just name a few of his discoveries, because he, like, in a number of a few months, he made more discoveries than almost any scientist made in their lifetime. So, for example, he saw that the surface of the moon was covered with mountains and craters. Now, you may think, oh, well, what's the big deal? Well, it is a huge deal, because until that point, people thought that everything here on Earth has blemishes, is corruptible, can die, but things in the heavens have to be pristine and perfect. He showed that the surface of the moon is just like the surface of the Earth, roughly speaking. He discovered four satellites of Jupiter. These were the first bodies since antiquity discovered in the solar system, new bodies. But not only that, by discovering those four moons of Jupiter, he answered objections to the Copernican system, in which, all the planets revolve around the sun. Because people were saying, well, if the Earth is just another planet, how come it's the only planet that has a moon? Well, not so, Galileo said. Jupiter has four moons. And they also asked, how come the Earth, if it's moving around the sun, it's not losing its moon? Well, here was Jupiter revolving around, choose your thing, Earth or Sun, but not losing four moons. He discovered that the Milky Way was composed of a vast number of stars of different luminosities, different brightnesses. So, this is just a few of the things, but every one of those was revolutionary.
How, I don't know if you've ever seen a telescope like, or used a telescope like the one he had, but how did he see all these things? It would seem to me that, because I understand that he found out about the principles of telescopes because they were of a because it was a spyglass used on a different country's ships, and so he took one and adapted it to become a telescope. What could he see?
Well, he did not invent the telescope. The telescope was invented in the Netherlands, and the telescopes that were used were at the power of four, sort of magnification of four. But he very quickly improved on those telescopes by constructing his own telescopes and polishing his own lenses. He basically used at the beginning tubes from, organ pipes. And he put two lenses at the two ends of those pipes and polished the telescope. And very quickly, he managed to have a telescope with a power of 20 or more. So he really could see much better than all the available telescopes at the time. But then, in addition, of course, he had this incredible foresight of, instead of using the telescope to spy on his neighbors, let's say, to actually direct this to the heavens.
Your book is called Galileo and the Science Deniers, and we're going to talk a lot about science denial and through history and today as well. But you worked on the Hubble telescope. In addition to science deniers, there are science naysayers, and a lot of people didn't see any reason to spend so much money on this telescope, which initially did not work because of a bad mirror, which was later replaced by astronauts. And people were saying, yeah, it produces some interesting pictures, but so what? Well, tell me so what? Because we've learned a lot from the Hubble telescope, have we
Oh,
not?
yeah, we've learned truly a lot. Look, I mean, this is how science advances. And especially when you do big science, there is always, some errors can happen. And indeed, there was some problem with the original mirror. But then, through the ingenuity of scientists, engineers, and through the bravery of astronauts, they managed to install corrective optics to the telescope, just like putting glasses on our eyes and making it better. And eventually the telescope became better than it was even originally thought to be. It told us so many new things about our universe and our place within it. We now know that in our universe there are something like 2 trillion galaxies like the Milky Way. We know that our universe is not only expanding, but accelerating, you know, speeding up. The expansion is speeding up. We have found the composition of the atmospheres of planets revolving around other stars, a crucial step towards trying to find life elsewhere in the universe. All of these just came, and all of these, you know, add to this those incredible images that everybody just loves, you know, and somebody called them the Sistine Chapel of our time, you know, the beauty of those images.
But tell me why it's important. We're facing this pandemic for which we need to find a vaccine and or a cure very quickly as humanly possible. So taking money away from that and putting it in the space program or other scientific experiments that may or may not have immediate effect on human life, such as the Hubble telescope and its discoveries, how does that help us? Why should we continue to do things like this, aside from our own expansion of knowledge?
Because, well, our own expansion of knowledge is very important in itself. Yes, I mean, we humans are very, very curious, and we have always been curious. And this curiosity has driven, you know, our search. We always looked for answers to things that did not have necessarily immediate things. Let me tell you a story. There's Michael Faraday. He's one of the fathers of electromagnetism. You know, no one would ask today for what we need electromagnetism. The fact that we are able to talk today is only possible because we understand that field. When he started his experiment, somebody from the government came and asked him, but Mr. Faraday, what good are your experiments for? You know, he was doing experiments with electricity and magnets and so on. And he said, you know what, I will tell you, I don't actually know what good it's for, but I'm pretty sure that very soon you'll be able to collect taxes on this. So that's how it goes. Basic research, you never see immediately the fruits, the you know, for everyday life. But I'll give you another example. You know, we all hold a phone in our hand, a cell phone today. This cell phone, as it uses the GPS system. The GPS system, believe it or not, relies both on Einstein's theory of special relativity and on his theory of general relativity. And without those two, it would have been completely wrong, the GPS system, in terms of telling us where to go. Now, you would not have thought that special and general relativity would have any influence on your everyday life, and yet it does.
And quite often, as we're discovering, even with drugs, that things that experiments that are conducted to discover things about whatever it may be, the scientists don't know where this will lead. And other scientists look at something that's been deemed worthless and find a great use for it down the road. We don't know exactly what we don't know. Getting back to Galileo, it was Copernicus who first postulated that the Earth revolved around the sun. And correct me if I'm wrong, you say that Galileo supported that theory. Did he prove that theory with his experiments?
Okay, he did not prove it totally in the following sense. He did prove that the other theory, the Aristotelian Ptolemaic theory, that everything was revolving around the Earth, that was wrong. That he managed to prove unambiguously. What he had no direct proof for was that the Earth itself was actually moving around the sun. He showed lots of pieces of evidence that suggested that, but there was still some hybrid model suggested by another astronomer, which said, well, maybe it is like this, that all the other planets revolve around the sun, but the sun itself revolves around the Earth. And Galileo did not manage to actually completely disprove.
And that got him in trouble, and we'll find out how in a moment.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Mario Livio, an astrophysicist, fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the author of 7 books, including the one we're talking about this morning, Galileo and the Science Deniers. Galileo postulated or followed the Copernican theory that the Earth revolved around the sun, and Pope Paul V forbade him from teaching that or writing about the idea, and he complied until a new pope, Pope Urban, I've forgotten the number after Urban's name, but a new pope came to power, and the new pope was a friend of Galileo's. And yet, so Galileo, I guess, stepped forward and pushed the envelope a little too much, and then suddenly he's accused of heresy. He's convicted, sentenced to house arrest for the rest of his life. And after his death, the church, I believe, would not even let him be buried with his family. How is it that it took the church until 1990? This happened in the 1600s. Why did it take the church until 1992 to admit they were wrong?
Well, really, we should ask the church that, I think. Why did it take him that long? The thing is the following. Let me clarify something. The conflict that Galileo had with the church was not, it is often described as a conflict between science and religion. It was not, and Galileo never saw it as such. It was a conflict between science and literal interpretations of the Bible. Literal interpretations. Galileo was arguing that, look, the Bible was written for our salvation. It was not written as a science book. And the fact is that even the planets are not named in the Bible. And therefore, he argued that when there is an apparent discrepancy between the biblical text and what observations tell you, you should simply understand that your interpretation was wrong and, you know, change the interpretation. Basically, you know, he said at one point that he did not believe that the same God who has given us our senses and intelligence and reason wished us to abandon their use. So that was the point. Now, the Ptolemaic or Aristotelian model in which everything revolved around the earth really fit very nicely into this general idea that humans are the center of creation and so on. And so removing the earth from its central position in the universe was something that was difficult for church officials to accept.
And yet, once again, correct me if I'm wrong, I think you point out in the book that St. Augustine in the 5th century, Galileo was around in the 17th century, but in the 5th century, 12 centuries prior to that, he had written that sacred writers did not intend to teach science since knowledge was of no use to salvation. So he was echoing, Galileo was echoing that sentiment. Why was that so controversial given that St. Augustine had said it in the 5th century?
Yeah, but then lots of centuries passed and the Ptolemaic Aristotelian model became part of the church's orthodoxy. And, you know, they relied on passages like that from the book of Joshua, where it says that, you know, God commanded at Joshua's request the sun to stand still above the Canaanite city of Gibeon and so on. So they took that literally, you know, okay, look, it was the sun that stopped and not the earth. So sentences like this convinced them that the earth had to be still.
I suppose we shouldn't point fingers of blame at the people in the 17th century because we're still having these same conversations today in the 21st century to a great degree. But and I guess it would be easy to understand Galileo's skeptics back in his day because science was in its infancy and he was the person who invented the scientific method. Very few people were familiar with it back then, but people are. They should have today a fundamental understanding of the scientific method, and they certainly have a knowledge of what science has made possible and brought to human existence, and that has improved and saved lives over time. So how do you explain the ongoing skepticism of science?
It is not easy to explain, to be honest. I believe that it has to do with several types of motivations. In Galileo's time, the main motivation was religiosity. As I said, it was a conflict between literal interpretations of scripture and what science was saying. Today, sometimes it is that, but rarely. It is that when people, for example, there are those people who want to teach creationist ideas in science classes, side by side with Darwinian evolution. Then religiosity is a motivation. But more often, the motivation for science denial today has to do with political conservatism, and sometimes even very simple reasons like, you know, wanting to be reelected or something of that nature. So we see that today. That is the case, for example, in the case of climate change, which, you know, there are science deniers of climate change. And there it is political conservatism. There are those who refuse to vaccinate their children, you know, even though they put their children's lives at risk as a result of this. Again, this mostly has to do with political conservatism and not with religiosity, but sometimes religiosity plays a role.
I can understand why, I don't agree with it, but I can understand why people might be reluctant to vaccinate their children because they don't understand the science or they don't trust the science behind vaccination, and they think it causes other problems that they wouldn't have if they didn't vaccinate their children. And I understand politicians not wishing to get on board with certain kinds of science, scientific discoveries that may fly in the face of public policy that they are benefiting from in some way, including their own reelection. But why do ordinary people who do not have a stake in standing with the status quo, but really have a stake in, when it comes to climate change or fossil fuel usage, we have to breathe the air. We have a stake in that. Why are there people who support politicians that don't go along with science?
Yeah, but you see, I mean, when you have people at very high positions who first denounce climate change as being a hoax or a Chinese plot to steal away jobs from American workers, and that thing gets, you know, dispersed by various types of media and so on, then this becomes something that people like. You know, people like to have to blame somebody for problems or misfortunes. This is true also during the current COVID-19 pandemic. A recent poll shows, for example, that 29% of Americans still think that the COVID-19 virus was actually manufactured by the Chinese, even though scientists have said categorically that that's not the case, because when such viruses are being manufactured artificially, it always leaves a marker in the virus. And this was not found. So there is no question that the virus has natural causes.
Explain that, because people don't understand that. I don't understand that. If you were to manufacture this virus in a lab, you say that would leave a marker. What would that look like? How easy would that be to find by scientists who are looking for it?
Scientists who are looking for this, you know, and look at the DNA that was published, you know, of this virus and so on, could immediately tell whether or not this is a manufactured virus or one that comes from natural causes.
So is part of the problem a simple lack of understanding of the scientific method?
Well, that certainly is part of the problem. I think that it starts with education. You know, I mean, in the education system, we have to, not everybody should be taught to be a scientist. Absolutely not. You know, we need artists, we need literature people, we need humanities, we need everything. But everyone should understand that science is a part of human culture and should learn to have an appreciation of science. I mean, you know, we are talking about Galileo. At the time of Galileo, life expectancy was half of what it is today. That's only because of science. Now, there is a very important point here to make. Science isn't always right. Science many times is wrong, and scientists are the first to recognize this. They see science as provisional and always open to revisions based on new data. But science also self-corrects. You know, it's the reason, you know why Wikipedia is relatively good? Because people keep correcting it. If there are mistakes in it, other people can correct. Science self-corrects. Sometimes the self-correction takes a short time and sometimes it takes a longer time, but it always corrects at the end.
And that's one of the problems with climate change. People, it's a long-term thing. It's a marathon and not a sprint. and to change, if we in fact have an effect on the climate, which most scientists believe we do, to make the changes necessary to reverse that effect or limit that effect is very, very expensive. So people say, well, what if it's wrong? What if it's you in your book talk about Galileo being wrong at times. He was wrong about how the tides work. Well, that seems to be much less of an impact than being wrong about our impact on the climate. So help a layperson understand how we know when to accept the theories of scientists.
So here is the thing. It is never a good idea to bet against the science. When you are dealing with...
So says things, the scientist.
Yes. No, it's never a good idea to bet against the science. Now, when what is at stake is human life, like in the case of COVID-19 pandemic, or the actual future of life on Earth, as in the case of climate change, it's really unconscionable to bet against the science. Now, how can you believe? Okay, let me just say a few things. 97% of the scientists of the world agree that climate change is not only real, but has that humans contribute to the problem. Now, let's suppose you are not absolutely convinced, but when you see, for example, the rate of change of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere in the last 50 years, in the last 10,000 years, in the last 800,000 years we can do now through ice cores, there is very little doubt that humans had an effect on this. So even if you don't think they are the main cause, clearly continuing to use fossil fuels and things like that don't help the problem. So why take the risk? Yes, it costs money, of course, to battle this pandemic. It costs money, but you know, it saves human lives.
So Galileo suffered from science denial personally and professionally, and died alone in his house because he was confined there by the Pope. And I guess science denial dates back to that. Are we at the apex of science denial, or have there been other periods when people accepted what scientists had to say?
I think science denial was always there at some level, but you know, there are, you know, waves of more and less of it. As the scientific revolution came about, which Galileo was one of those who initiated it, there was a lot of science denial at the beginning, but then for a while, you know, people got more confidence in science. I think that, you know, if you look at in the US, then somewhat depending on, you know, attitudes that come from the top, you had periods of less science denial and periods of more. You know, I think that, you know, when we started going to space and things, people had a stronger belief in science and pride in it. I think that today we are unfortunately facing a phase where there is somewhat of an anti-science attitude.
But why? Because I remember growing up as a kid, there were commercials on television for companies like DuPont and General Electric who touted science and their contributions to science. And those contributions impact, positive impact, on their customers, us. How do we go from that in a short amount of time to people denying the science around COVID-19, around climate change, etc.?
You know, I wish I could really understand that. But look, we've also gone now through a period of more conservative ideas. It's very hard to understand. The fact also, let me point the following. In Galileo's time, he used the invention of print, and that helped, you know, outreach of science, but it also helped disseminate other types of ideas. Now we have social media, and in social media, conspiracy theories are very easy to put on. You know, everybody can put on. They don't even need to put any proofs. It is enough that you say, oh, people say that. And, you know, that's enough. It's there, and it could take off And many people listen to that, you know, and it is very, very difficult to combat. Like I said, the only way to combat it, I think, is to try to prevent it from starting in the first place, yeah, as opposed to combating it once it's already up there.
You point out that Galileo lived in a time of the printing press, when the printing press was just coming into use, and it enabled people to have greater access to information because books became more readily available than the ones they had to transcribe by hand. And they began to be written in the vernacular, which gave people the ability to understand it because it wasn't in Latin or Greek. And you say it resembles the change we're going through right now with the explosion of internet, social media, email services, and more. So this is Gutenberg on steroids that we're running through today, right?
Exactly right. Yes, exactly right.
And you wrote that looking back on Galileo helps us shine a light on current concerns. You cite, quote, the blatant dismissal in some circles of the research on climate change, the mocking attitude directed at the funding of basic research, and the elimination of budgets for the arts and public radio in the United States. Only a few examples. Expand on that. How does the defunding of arts and public radio figure into the discussion of similarities to the attacks that Galileo went through?
Well, you know, I mean, look, I mentioned, for example, conspiracy theories. Believe it or not, there were conspiracy theories in Galileo's time as well. For example, at one point, his enemies wrote something that Galileo wrote a horoscope predicting the death of the Pope. This was, by the way, Pope Urban VIII. Now Galileo never did that. He never wrote a horoscope predicting the death of the Pope, but his enemies wrote that. Luckily for Galileo, he knew the Pope. He directly talked to him and convinced him he had nothing to do with it. But this is the types of things that, you know, happen now, and now it's very much more difficult to combat.
Mario Livio is an astrophysicist and the author of Galileo and the Science Deniers. We will continue our conversation about science denial, the history of it, the impact of it, and the impact of science, actual discoveries, actual real science, when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Mario Livio, an astrophysicist who worked on the Hubble Telescope Project, a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the author of seven books. The one we're talking about this morning, Galileo and the Science Deniers, which has particular import today because people are denying the science of COVID-19 in many cases, and climate change, and when it comes to climate change, the intersection of fossil fuels and climate change is what the big bugaboo here, I suppose, is. And fossil fuels are all tied up in the economy and in politics. But you've said that you find Donald Trump's continued promotion of fossil fuels as, quote, nothing short of shocking. Given the fact of his connections to business, why does that shock you?
Well, it does shock me because we're talking here about the future of life on this planet. So business is important. Economics are important. I'm not an economist myself. I'm a scientist. I can speak only from the scientific perspective. When we are facing a rate of rise in the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and consequently, we're experiencing the hottest years on record in recent years, and an enormous increase in the severity of various natural phenomena, such as storms and so on. And, you know, the specter of sea rising, which, you know, entire countries such as Bangladesh, maybe even Florida, you know, can find themselves underwater in not that long. Then clearly, you know, ignoring that is just really incredible. And I find that incredible and shocking.
I want to get your explanation of something I think that I'm having trouble understanding out of your book. You point out that climate change deniers have tried to argue against the scientific finding that that global climate change is happening. And they point to Galileo as an example of this. They say that because he was mocked and persecuted for his views by a majority of people in his time, but later proven to be right, that those persecuted today for their beliefs that climate change is nonsense must also be right.
Yeah,
that's illogical and counterintuitive to me, but explain that.
Well, it really is a complete logical fallacy. I mean, the argument says something like, okay, look, Galileo was fighting against the mainstream at that time, and at the end he was proven to be right. Therefore, the handful of scientists who are arguing against climate change and against the majority of the scientific community must be right too. But the logic doesn't work this way. Galileo was right because he was right, not because he was one against the many. In most of cases, one against the many are actually wrong. Galileo happens to be one of those very few exceptions where he was actually right. And that's it. But the logic doesn't flow that way.
You've also said that the early dismissal of the warnings of scientists about the coronavirus pandemic was not only disastrous, but it underlines one of the most important lessons we can glean from Galileo, and that is, believe the science. You say to bet against science, and you've already talked about this a little bit, when human life is at stake, is insane. In this case, science offered no solutions other than social distancing and wearing masks and an economic shutdown. So until we get a vaccine. So how do you balance the prescription of science with the prescriptions of economists?
Yeah, well, let me say again, I'm not an economist, okay? Let me make this very clear. But here is the point. I looked, for example, on May 14, I looked at the numbers in the US and compared them, let's say, to South Korea, okay? Mm-hmm. South Korea has 52 million people. The US has 328. So we are about six times larger than South Korea. But it's not a small country. If you look at the number of deaths per million population in both countries, the number in the US, it was 264. 264 for every million in the population died in the US. Do you know how many died in South Korea? Five. Five per million. Okay, five instead of 264. Now, what's the difference? The difference is that from the very early signs, you know, the first cases were around the same date in the two countries, but they immediately introduced social distancing, tracing, testing and tracing contact, and tracking the people and isolating them, and so on. All of this was introduced, and this was the result. So this acts which you say are very simple, you know, like social distancing, but it's not just social distancing. It's also the testing, it's the contact tracing, it's the tracking and the isolation of cases that you find. That made a difference of five versus 264.
I know you're not a reporter, but how did they achieve that? How did they police it? How did they enforce it?
Well, they invested actually hundreds of millions of dollars in the tracing system and in, you know, isolating people. So we're doing this now. I mean, we're doing much more of it now, but we lost some very, very precious weeks at the beginning.
Were the Korean scientists and mental and health experts, rather, were they pushing for this earlier than our scientists and health experts were pushing for it here?
I believe, well, to some extent, yes. And look, there are differences in the culture and things like this. If you've been to Asia, I mean, people are much more used to wearing masks there. You see them much more often. You saw them even before the COVID-19 pandemic in Asia, you know, in China, in Japan, you see lots of people wearing masks. normally. So all of these things maybe came more naturally to them. And also the idea that, you know, you can be traced and with using your phone and so on and put in this play or and isolated if necessary. So it was certainly more difficult to do it here. But statements such as, oh, we have now 15 cases and very soon it will be close to zero, that did not help for sure. And that happened, you know, as late as beginning of March.
And those flew, you're talking about things that the president has said, and those things flew in the face of the science and of scientists and of particularly Anthony Fauci, who seems to be the lead scientist in this case. And you have compared Dr. Fauci's struggle to explain the implications of coronavirus and of social distancing to the struggles that Galileo went through in terms of trying to explain his belief that the Earth was the center of the universe. Has it always been this way? Has it always been a difficult slog for scientists to make lay people who don't understand the science understand?
It was never easy, I would say. It was never easy, but it is sometimes more difficult than at other times. People such as, I don't know, President Kennedy could be perhaps easier convinced of how science works than the current president. But look, there is one other thing which I like to quote because it says so much. There is this philosopher, Hannah Arendt. And Hannah Arendt wrote once that the ideal subject of totalitarian rule is not the convinced Nazi or the convinced communist, but people for whom the distinction between fact and fiction and the distinction between true and false no longer exist. It is so dangerous when you reach a situation where facts are almost dead. I fear that we are somewhat in that situation now.
And you've written that Galileo would probably not be surprised to hear that the political considerations can surpass scientific findings, but he would be terrified, you write, by the death of facts. That's where we are today, right?
Yes, unfortunately, because he is the one, as I mentioned this before, who established what are the ways to determine what are facts. And the ways are very precise. It is experiments, observations, and then making conclusions based on data from those experiments and conclusions. I mean, look, like I said, it's not that science cannot be wrong. But, you know, this model that comes out of University of Washington predicted that by June 1st, we will get to 100,000 dead, unfortunately. And we have. Now, at the beginning, they were predicting 67,000. Why have the numbers changed? Because more data were collected. As more data were collected, the input data into the models becomes better. The models become better, and you can make, you know, more precise predictions. But the general trend was there.
So given that you know this, Dr. Fauci certainly knows this, Dr. Deborah Birx, who has become the second leading spokesperson on this, at the White House at least, she knows this. They must be equally appalled with some of the things that the president has said that fly in the face of science, and they deal in facts. What should they be doing? What should they be saying at this point about all of this? Should they put themselves at risk and say, no, Mr. President, you're wrong. This is what the truth is. This is what the science says. Or should they be acting the way they are now, trying to hold on and get out as much information as they can and preserve their place in the government so that at least somebody there who understands this will remain there?
Well, you know, I believe they are doing this very, very delicate, you know, walking on eggshells, basically, because you're absolutely right. You diagnosed it correctly. I mean, they could say, you know, when the president says that Maybe we should research into injecting bleach or putting UV light into the body. You know, the natural reaction should be, no, this is absolute nonsense and it's dangerous to your health. But at the same time, if they say that, there is no question that they will be fired immediately and then they will have no voice there. So it is an extremely delicate act that they have to go through. And I believe that what they are trying to do is to say as much of the truth as they can while still keeping their position there, because otherwise there will be nobody to say these things.
We've talked about this before on this program, that a lot of people don't really, they never run into scientists. They never talk about science with scientists. Their only intersection with science is in eighth grade science class or something in high school. And their total impression of scientists is being molded by movies and television shows that often portray scientists as evil or deranged in some way, and with these wacky experiments that threaten mankind. Galileo wrote his findings in the vernacular. He wrote in Italian, not in Latin, which had been the tradition, so that people could read and understand what he was saying. Are we teaching science in such a way that we are helping people understand and embrace scientists and scientific findings?
I think not enough. I mean, surely we're trying to do that, but not enough. And look, this is one of the reasons I write books like this, yes? I write a book, Galileo and the Science Deniers. I'm a scientist, but I write the book in such a way that I believe that most people can actually read and understand it. So I try to bridge this gap, you know, between the scientists and the general public. And Galileo was fantastic at that. Not only he wrote in the vernacular, as you pointed out, but he also sent telescopes all across Europe to people of influence for them to be able to see what he discovered with their own eyes. He managed to get the Tuscan court to fund that, for him to do that. So he was, in some sense, a fantastic outreach scientist as well.
We don't have a lot of time to talk about this because we're very short on time at the moment. But I wanted to get into the whole idea of teaching intelligent design as an option to Darwin's theory of evolution. And we don't really have time to talk about that. But I did want to ask a question about why you think some people have difficulty in believing scientific findings about things we cannot see. We cannot see the coronavirus without electron microscopes. So why do certain people who deny science deny it because we can't see it? There's no physical evidence of it. And yet they will say the Bible says this, but we can't see any physical evidence necessarily of a God. How do you explain that?
I don't. I'll be honest with you. I cannot explain this. I mean, again, I think it has to do with education from a very, very young age. I mean, we have to start education and appreciation of science from a very, very young age, and that I think is the only hope.
And how would you suggest we do that? Increase funding for science education?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Absolutely, yes. Increase funding for science education so that you can get also better teachers.
Well, congratulations on your 7 books. Congratulations on your work with the Hubble telescope, because that's remarkable. Mario Livio is an astrophysicist, a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He has 7 books that are written, as we say, in the vernacular. You can actually understand what he's talking about when it comes to science. The latest one is called Galileo and the Science Deniers. Thank you for the hour.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.